I'm Laura Shefsack, and you're listening to A Cell Paperclip. Back in grad school, some classmates and I went to the Great American Beer Fest in Denver. Picture a huge convention center floor filled with row after row of eager brewers pouring samples of their latest and most experimental brews. Some were great, and some were atrocious. Evidence for the production of yeast-based fermented beverages like beer goes back over 5,000 years. And now, even in your local beer or wine shop, there's a staggering variety of choices, each with a characteristic flavor and smell. This abundance comes in part from domestication of early yeast strains, which, according to new work from Kevin Verstreppen and Stephen Mata's labs, happened only a few hundred years ago. Here to tell us more is Kevin Verstreppen. Kevin, it would be better if we were sampling some beer together, but we'll have to make do with having you on the line. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you. It's great. I mean, it's more attention to our paper, so fabulous.
Yeah, so I'm curious, how did you get started, you know, taking a very sort of modern genetic approach to studying fermented things like beer and wine?
Well, we're a yeast lab, and yeasts are, of course, a very important model system for genetics and molecular biology in general. People are using yeast as a very simple model for, say, human cells, for example, and that's what we're doing. But, of course, my lab is in Belgium, and we like beer here. We have a lot of breweries around and also chocolate makers. And at some point, I got contacted both by a couple of breweries and a chocolate maker who were all looking for better yeast. And so we figured, well, yeah, why not try this? And it sounded like a fun subject, right?
Right. And in the paper, you really focus on analyzing industrial yeast in this applied context. What makes an industrial yeast an industrial yeast?
That's a good question, and one of the things that we're trying to reveal in the paper. But I guess yeasts are categorized broadly maybe in three groups. You have the wild yeasts, the microbes out there that live in nature, soil, insects. Then you have the lab yeasts, which is a small group of yeasts that are typically used by researchers as a model. And then you have the industrial yeast, and by definition, those are just the yeasts that are used in industry to make beer, wine, bread, biofuels, and also green chemicals and drugs. But I guess it wasn't exactly known what separated all these. And one of the things that our study really showed is that these industrial yeasts really are a completely genetically separated lineage family from the lab yeast and the wild or feral yeast.
And so that's as a result of domestication. And so maybe you can explain in the context of yeast how you think about domestication. I mean, we're used to thinking about it in terms of crops or livestock. Tell me about yeast.
Mm-hmm. Right, you're absolutely right. We all know the process of domestication when it comes to pets. You know, dogs are clearly domesticated wolves. And for yeast, it's exactly the same. It's a bit weird maybe because it's a microbe. You don't literally pet the yeast, although we sometimes want to. But from a biological, genetical point of view, exactly the same things happen. So ancient brewers got some yeast from nature, and somehow this yeast really started living in the brewery and lost contact with its natural habitat. And brewers then also kept selecting the better natural variants that made better beers, that did exactly what they wanted to do. One of the other cool things that came out of our study is that we were able to date when this first happened, so when, around what time the very first yeast sort of got into these breweries. And this seems to have happened in the 16th century, which is interesting because this is before microbes were even discovered. So somehow brewers were domesticating microbes before people knew what microbes were. But then if you go back to ancient writings from brewers, we know that they were using backslopping, which is a technical term to say that they were reusing part of the beer that they made to inoculate a next batch of beer. And what they were effectively doing is they were transferring some of the yeast that had been growing in the first batch, and they were transferring those cells into a new batch. And so they were, in a way, doing a long-term evolution experiment.
Because you've been able to look at so many strains, some of which have been growing for hundreds of years, can you tell just based on the sequence properties of a strain whether it's used for beer or something else, like bioethanol production?
Not with 100% precision, but I would say that if we get the genome sequence of a beer yeast, we would probably guess right that it is a beer yeast. And beer yeasts are a bit different even from wine yeast and biofuel yeast, in the sense that they probably are the most domesticated yeasts. In a way, the wine yeasts are cats and the beer yeasts are dogs, right? The wine yeasts are still a bit wilder. So the beer yeasts are really very distinct. And you also see that they have lost the ability for sexual reproduction. Yeast need to mostly think about sexual reproduction when the environment goes bad, when there's starvation or lots of stress. They form spores then that can survive the stress. And beer yeasts, for the most part, have lost the ability to go through the sexual cycle of sporulation. We can actually see this. We see some mutations in the genes responsible for meiosis and sporulation. And also, we see lots of chromosomal changes, duplications, deletions, rearrangements, to a much higher extent than, for example, in wine yeast or in wild yeast. So for beer yeast, we can really just look at the genome sequence and say, okay, this is probably a beer yeast. And to be honest, looking at the genomes is pretty scary. It's almost like an anti-drinking campaign. I mean, the genomes are a mess, which made it also more difficult to analyze them. It wasn't a routine analysis. And Brigida is still, the first author of the paper, still recovering from having to deal with these really awkward genomes.
And so does looking at the genomes tell us something new about the process of domestication?
Maybe the coolest example of domestication, because it really proves human interference, is that beer yeast were selected against formation of a certain unwanted flavor, which is called 4-VG or 4-vinyl guaiacol. It's a smoky, phenolicky, plastic flavor that you do find in German Hefeweizen beers, and there it's desirable, but in most other beers, it's really not a good thing. And so we could clearly see in the genomes that right from the beginning, brewers started selecting against the genes that are responsible for making this off flavor.
One of the ideas that comes out of the paper is that having looked at the sequences and sort of analyzed what happened during domestication, it's going to help make better beer in the future. And so what's to be gained? How can you use this information?
Absolutely. So one important point is that we already owe a lot to these ancient brewers who are really craftsmen, who didn't know microbes, but who were doing exactly the right things to make our beers already a lot better than the medieval beers. But what we can do now, and what we are already doing now in the lab, is looking at the genome sequences of yeast, and we know more and more which genes or which alleles or specific mutations are important for certain traits. And then instead of just taking some yeast that have these properties and crossing them and hoping that their siblings will combine these properties, we do that, but we use PCR or sequencing to really test genetically whether they combine all the good alleles from the parents that we want. And so this is called marker-assisted breeding. It's already been used in plants quite a bit. And so now we're starting to do this in microbes.
You mentioned that you also study chocolate. How does that fit in? And what do you find?
Yeah, that was exactly my question when this company called me. So I got a call from Barry Callebaut, the largest chocolate company in the world. So they called me. It's like, hi, we know that you're working with yeast and we'd like to get maybe better yeast for our chocolate. And I'm like, why do you need yeast for chocolate? As it turns out, chocolate is fermented just like beer. It's not exactly the same. There's no alcohol in there, but the process is pretty much the same. So chocolate starts out as cocoa beans, and these beans grow in pots about the size of a coconut. Mm-hmm. And these coconuts or these pots hold around 40 beans. And they grow in the tropics, and the farmers harvest them. They slice open the pots, and they spill the beans, usually just on a few banana leaves or sometimes in a plastic box. And the beans, when they come out of the pots, are surrounded by a white, gooey, sugar-rich pulp. It's a very viscous pulp. And so what happens is that you get a spontaneous fermentation or rottening process pretty much of this pulp. So you have all kinds of microbes that just fall into the beans and onto the pulp. They start eating the sugars in the pulp. And at the same time, you get liquefaction. So you get a liquid phase that simply drains away. And in the end, you end up with the clean beans, which are then dried, roasted, and shipped to Europe to process them further into chocolate. So it's a completely spontaneous process. You just have all these bugs falling in there, and depending on which bugs fall in, you get better or worse chocolate. And so sometimes companies have to throw out some of the cocoa because it's not good enough, or they have to blend it in with better batch so that consumers don't notice anymore that there's some awful, rotten tastes in there. So companies are now thinking about maybe doing the same what wine makers and beer makers and bakers are doing, to simply add the perfect microbes that make the perfect flavors to the fermenting bean so that the wild microbes don't get the upper hand anymore and that you get a consistent, good quality. And so that's what we did. It turned out that the same yeast, the same baker's and brewer's yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, is also the best yeast for fermenting cocoa. And it's also what happens in nature, although there's others that fall in and then things don't go as well. So we isolated lots of yeast from spontaneous cocoa fermentations from Africa and Asia, and then started breeding them with beer and wine yeast that make even better flavors to combine, you know, the good fermentation of cocoa with good flavors. And we came out with a few hybrids that actually make pretty good chocolate. So in between tasting beer, sometimes we have to taste chocolate.
Sounds like your lab is a fabulous place to work.
Yeah, but the boss is horrible, so, you know, there's always good and bad things.
All right, Kevin, thanks for a fun conversation.
Okay, thank you.
Kevin Verstreppen and his colleagues use genetics and genomics to study system-scale questions of biology at KU Leuven. You can read about his latest work in the September 8th issue of Cell. You can find it online at cell.com. I'm Lara Shefsack, and you've been listening to a Cell Paperclip.